This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Britain on Saturday readied armed Royal Navy ships to patrol its fishing waters if tempers flare after a no deal on Brexit. The move comes as a deadline approaches for talks with the European Union. Four vessels have been placed on standby to guard British waters from EU trawlers in case the two sides decide to abandon efforts to secure a free trade agreement on Sunday. The development is part of increased contingency planning on both sides of the channel. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said it is very, very likely the talks will fail and that Britain will revert to World Trade Organization terms. WTO terms would mean tariffs and quotas and the reintroduction of border checks. European leaders have also been told the chances of a deal are slim, with both sides at odds over rules to govern fair competition and fishing rights in British territorial waters. Deal or no deal, Britain will leave the EU single market and customs union on December 31st. Algeria's prime minister on Saturday criticized foreign maneuvers he said were aimed to destabilize it after Washington recognized Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara in exchange for Morocco normalizing ties with Israel. The prime minister's comments were Algeria's first reaction to the U.S. decision. In reference to Israel, he added, quote, "There is now a desire by the Zionist entity to come closer to our borders," end quote. Algeria neighbors Morocco and backs the Polisario Front, which has campaigned for independence for the former Spanish colony of Western Sahara since the 1970s. Meanwhile, an advisor to Iran's supreme leader has condemned Morocco's normalization of ties with Israel, calling it a betrayal of Islam. The kingdom on Thursday became the fourth Arab state this year to normalize relations with Israel in a deal announced by outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump. This is VOA News. Hong Kong democracy activist Jimmy Lai appeared in court Saturday to face charges under the city's national security law. The 73-year-old has been accused of colluding with foreign forces, according to his Apple Daily newspaper. The paper cited a police source. Lai, who is an outspoken critic of Beijing, is currently the highest-profile person to have been charged under the new law, which was placed on the city by China's national government in June. Apple Daily is a tabloid known for its critical stance on China. The security law punishes what Beijing broadly defines as secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. It can be punished with a sentence of life in jail. Western governments and human rights groups have condemned the law as a tool to crush dissent. Chinese authorities claim it covers holes in national security defenses. Hong Kong police did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected a Texas lawsuit to invalidate the November 3rd presidential election results in four battleground states that President Donald Trump lost to his Democratic rival Joe Biden. In a brief unsigned order, the Supreme Court said Texas does not have standing to sue Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The lawsuit was filed on Monday by Trump ally and Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and backed by other GOP state attorneys general, as well as 126 Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives. It asked the Supreme Court to delay the Electoral College vote and to prevent the four states from casting their electoral votes on Monday. The Supreme Court's widely expected dismissal of the suit comes after state and federal courts across the country rejected more than three dozen GOP-led challenges to the election results. Biden has won 306 electoral votes, 36 more than he needs, to Trump's 232 votes. The presidential electors are expected to approve Biden's victory on Monday. Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Supreme Court takes up a challenge filed by President Trump's team to try to overturn his election loss to Biden. Wisconsin's highest court, which is controlled by conservatives, is holding a weekend session to hear the Trump campaign's argument for disqualifying more than 200,000 absentee ballots. Trump's attorney wants his electors' ballots to be sent to Congress, so if a court does intervene, the Trump votes would be counted instead of Biden's. The presidential's legal team continues trying to challenge elections in key battleground states. And Switzerland has frozen the financial assets of the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, following the violent aftermath of the elections in the East European country. He and his son are among 15 people banned from entering or traveling through Switzerland, the government said. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
With the fact that they regionalize things and the fact that Ghana's territory is so large, the number of poles for so many to cover, I think you've got to say to them that they did a job well done. It was well done.
The head of the ECOWAS Poll Observer Mission says Ghana's recent elections were transparent and credible.
So the introduction of digital technology into our campaign has been very, very helpful and useful. And I have no regrets at all about that. The African countries are learning and copying from us our digital technology.
The campaign manager for the Ghanaian incumbent President Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo's re-election campaign says hard work pays off.
Those countries that have actually committed are also helping in encouraging the other countries that haven't to come on board, because this agenda, this campaign is definitely worth investing in and actually realizing at a national level, because every country has its own respective peace and security issues.
And the African Union holds a two-day summit to discuss ways of ending conflict on the continent. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Of the ECOWAS Poll Observer Mission says Ghana's recent elections were transparent and credible. Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says despite a report of isolated cases of violence, the voters had no problem casting their votes. She also complimented officials of the Electoral Commission, including those at the polling stations, for carrying out their duties professionally. Her remarks come after the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, Attorney Jean Adukwe Mensah, declared incumbent President Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo winner of the presidential election with 51.59% of the total votes cast. His main challenger, former President John Dramani Mahama, came in second with 47.36%. To learn more about the assessment of the ECOWAS Poll Observer Mission monitoring the Ghanaian elections, I caught up with Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, former Liberian president and head of the Election Observer Group.
Madam President, talk to us about your overview of the Ghanaian election.
Ghanaian elections, I think, are exemplary. Exemplary because it was peaceful, because the entire process was transparent. Everyone could observe, including the average citizen who could stand at any of the polling places and watch the process, watch the vote, watch the counting of the votes. The fact that the party agents were very in close proximity with the process. They could see, you know, when the voter register was validated by the biometric device. They could see that process to make sure that the device worked. They could see when the vote was taken. Security agents were there, but they were very quiet, reserved. All they did was observe to make sure there was no infraction of the peace. The officers, you know, the election officers, were professional, how they handled. So what can I say about that? Yes, there were one or two incidents that we had reported in places where force, and unfortunately in one case is a shooting incident that involved in deaths. I think those sort of just put a small dot on Ghana's tradition of peaceful election with no incidents. And that again is a reflection of the fact that our societies have populations that are larger, that are younger, you know, that are more demanding, and sometimes when aggravated, you know, can react in a manner that's contrary to the usual. So I say we can give Ghana's election very high marks. I don't want to get into numbers.
Right.
I think that number will come from Kudeo.
Kudeo. The domestic poll observers.
Yes, and they will handle that.
Madam President, I was at the Electoral Commission so-called strong room when you came to be briefed about the electoral process, how they would get the results from the other regions. And I saw you nodding your head. Were you comfortable with the entire process in terms of how the Electoral Commission administered the poll?
Yes, I was, because everything I've said about the process of the polls followed what had been arranged by the Elections Commission. And everywhere there were issues. There were issues, for example, about the voter rolls. And I think they were addressed, and the numbers that now come out show that all those rolls did was to add those who had now qualified, the younger people that now qualified, having reached the voting age. There were issues about masks. And I think that was easily addressed by them, by ensuring that masks were sent to places for voters who did not have a mask. And so I think the Election Commission, under the circumstances with a huge population increase, with the fact that they regionalize things and the fact that Ghana's territory is so large, the number of polls are so many to cover, I think you've got to say to them that they did a job well done. It was well done.
Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a former Liberian president and head of the ECOWAS Election Observer Group. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Still in Ghana, Peter Mark Menu is the chairman for incumbent President Nanadu Dankwa Akufo-Addo's re-election campaign for this year's vote. He was also the campaign manager who led the former opposition New Patriotic Party leader to defeat incumbent President John Dramani Mahama in the 2016 polls, shortly after Attorney Jane Adukwe Mensah, chairperson of the country's Electoral Commission, declared the results of the presidential poll. I caught up with campaign chairman Peter Mark Menu at the party's campaign coalition center in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Tell us how you feel at the moment.
I feel great. I feel excited that at the end of it all, victory has come to the New Patriotic Party and our president, and therefore excited, so excited that the campaign, the objective of winning one touch first round has been achieved.
How did you make it?
Well, the answer is in one simple word: hard work. Hard work. Because whatever programs, policies, etc. you put in place, if you don't work hard towards it, you won't be able to achieve it. So we had a nice, beautiful campaign plan, but we worked hard to achieve, to execute the plan.
Since I got here, people have been talking about the history you've made. This is the second election that you have successfully managed. How do you feel about that, and what can people learn from your leadership?
I think if God blesses you with knowledge, you must use it or put it into the use of your party. The New Patriotic Party is a great party. I have always said that you cannot prosecute a good, excellent campaign without a base, and the base is the structures in the New Patriotic Party. I've been to other African countries. I look at their campaigns. Because they don't have the structures on the ground, they are weak. But we have a very good structure on which the campaign relies on to be able to reach the nook and cranny. And in this campaign, as was in 2016, but particularly under the COVID-19, we stress that we're going to do what we call retail campaign. That is direct voter contact and giving our message that will touch the heart of the voter in order to convince him to vote for us. So that if he also has any concerns, then he's able or she's able to raise it. So our direct voter contact in the form of what we call retail campaign paid off. And in the COVID era, we decided not to make any mass rallies because of social distancing and others. So we operated under the COVID, making sure that social distancing is obeyed, COVID protocols, hand washing, nose masking, etc. are obeyed. But the direct voter contact was the big thing. And I think voters appreciate it when you give them that respect.
How critical is innovation and technology helping your campaign to achieve the success that you've chalked today?
I can tell you that the digital directorate has been one of the anchors that has helped us
to know our results in advance. And it helps us keep to and focus on what we expected. Because, you see, we have been in a continent where election results has triggered many conflicts. Because the electoral management body may try to manipulate the results. But if political parties are able to do a parallel vote tabulation and know their results in advance, that's what Joe referred to. That's the speed, and it is accurate and timely done, timeliness. You don't have any problem because you'll be ahead of the electoral commission. So that when he is declaring his results, you have a comparison from what you yourself have been able to put in place. And you can't do this without technology, without digital technology. So the introduction of digital technology into our campaign has been very, very helpful and useful. And I have no regrets at all about that. The African countries are learning and copying from us our digital technology.
Peter Mark-Menu is the chairman for incumbent President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo's re-election campaign. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Earlier this month, the African Union held a two-day summit to discuss ways of ending conflict on the continent. The Silencing the Guns Coalition was formed to help achieve the objective of ending conflict. By so doing, the continental body endorsed a video called Pledge for Peace, which was launched at the recent Heads of State Summit. This, as African leaders appeal for collective action and are calling on civil society to play a key role in ending conflict on the continent. Analysts say the call is a positive move to unite Africans in the plan. Karabo Mokonyana is the African Union's Youth Peace Ambassador. I asked her about their own participation in efforts to end violence.
The aim is really to uplift the voices of grassroots activists, civil society, and just young peace builders across the continent in relation to how they would want to silence guns within their own respective communities, or equally, how they would want to silence the guns within their countries, because peace and security is not one-dimensional. It looks different for different communities. In one community, violence against women, it could be, you know, the main peace and security issue. In other communities, violent extremism could be an issue. So the campaign is really to drive the voices and agency of individuals who are not in the higher ranking positions, but individuals on the ground, people at community level, people who actually experience the peace and security issues that we constantly speak about.
So Karabo, how do you get the youth involved in this program?
So there are different ways. The first is, especially with the digital times, COVID-19, a lot of the campaign has moved to a digital lens. So there's been involvement in terms of tweet chats with involving young people, but also just campaigning surrounding young people, sharing their journeys, their stories on the ground, and asking young people how they would, you know, pledge for peace on the continent. And that's been one of the ways we've been doing it. But on our side as youth ambassadors, what we want to do is we are preparing for, in-person programming of how we can serve our respective regions, considering the differences in terms of the peace and security issues that we're experiencing. But we also formed a Youth for Peace network throughout the continent, where we've called on young people to join the African Union, but also the regional mechanisms in pushing, you know, to silence the guns in Africa and making sure that we mobilize as many young people as possible, because young people really do have the power to change narratives regarding having peaceful communities that are free from insecurity.
So far that you've had this program, what has been the enthusiasm generated and perhaps commitment to further this cause to stop this violence on the continent?
So far, I think in terms of the enthusiasm, especially from young people, is young people really taking ownership of silencing the guns. Because initially, when silencing the guns was introduced by the African Union, a lot of young people across the continent were finding it very difficult to identify with silencing the guns. It seemed like a very diplomatic, high-level type of agenda. So what this particular campaign has done is brought it down to the ground to young people, and young people have really taken it on. Young people are confident to say that, you know what, I'm participating in silencing the guns through the work that I do on the ground. And I think the commitment that we've seen is the investment in young people from a regional level. So regional mechanisms are like ECOWAS, like SEDEC and COMESA are all willing to come forward. And we've had consultations. We are making plans to implement programming on the ground. So it's that ownership level, but also the willingness from regional mechanisms to say we are on board and we are willing to support young people. So it has triggered institutional support on the continent.
Are you getting the political support from across Africa, particularly with these African leaders who basically sometimes people blame for fomenting some of these problems or challenges that you are helping to fight?
I think we are, we're halfway there. We're definitely getting a lot of support in that the PSC, which is mainly made up of member states, is on board regarding the advancement of silencing the guns narrative. However, there are countries that we are still trying to lobby in terms of adopting national action plans so that we can have it more on a domesticated level. So those countries that have actually committed are also helping in encouraging the other countries that haven't to come on board, because this agenda, this campaign is definitely worth investing in and actually realizing at a national level, because every country has its own respective peace and security issues.
Karabo Mokogana is the African Union's Youth Peace Ambassador. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. A Cameroonian lawyer says a recent strike by the lawyers group demanding reforms was successful. Barrister Amungwa Tanyi says the strike sends a strong signal to the government that routine interference in the affairs of the judiciary is unacceptable. His remarks come after the Cameroonian Bar Council embarked on a one-week strike to protest against what some members of the group say is the use of security forces against them. The lawyers accused the police of attacking them in a courtroom in the commercial capital Douala. This after the lawyers demanded that they leave. The police have accused some of the lawyers of corruption, an accusation they deny. To discuss the impact of the recent one-week strike action, I reached Barrister Amungwa Tanyi in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Well, Peter, I would say that our strike was successful to an extent, and we are expecting major reforms to take place as far as the bar is concerned in Cameroon. You know, we have a bi-jura system, and I'm talking to you in my capacity as a common law lawyer. And you know, the torturing of lawyers started with the common law lawyers in the Northwest and the Southwest region, and it finally landed in the civil law jurisdiction where tear gas was exploded in court halls. Well, successful because for 5 days we've been able to get the courts grounded. A majority of the lawyers adhered to the call, despite the fact that some 10 lawyers disassociated themselves with the fight. And at the end of it, the bar is talking tough and they will be appearing before the disciplinary council of the bar.
What happens if the reforms do not come as you anticipate or wished for?
Peter, the question you asked me is a bit tricky, but let me tell you, lawyers have that daunting task to work hard in order to see things happen to their favor. I don't think that it is a day job. We need to continue to push. A lawyer is an expert in law. And I say again, from my departing point like a common law lawyer, reforms are supposed to be proposed by lawyers. And once lawyers push those reforms, then they will definitely hear them. We need to use all the tools that are at our disposal. We started with a strike. We need to lobby. We need to call the attention of government that certain nomenclatures that they place on lawyers like auxiliary of the judiciary all of that, it doesn't occur that way. We need to impose on the system because the judiciary cannot go without the lawyers.
Barrister Tani, some Cameroonians have expressed concern about the independence of the judiciary and that it appears that the judiciary has been subservient to the executive, in this case, President Paul Biya. Some are saying that all the strike that you undertook will not have any effect because the president is still supreme and the judiciary is firmly under his control. What do you say to that?
Peter, like a common law lawyer, that is why you see the common law lawyers are lost in this system. Like I told you, we run a bajura system in Cameroon. We've never seen a system where it is the president of the country that appoints magistrate, is the president of the country that presides over the higher judiciary council of the country. We've never seen a system where there is a school where they call a magistracy school. We know under the common law system, lawyers are trained in a school that they call a law school. I was trained in Nigerian Law School. I'm a member of the Cameroon Bar and the Nigerian Bar Association. And I must confess to you, the bar in Cameroon, as you said, is subservient. It is under the president of the country. And we doubt everything that comes from our courts. And for that reason, you see, the two systems are not working in pari passu. So what you say is correct. But coming from the common law background, we've never ceased from getting our voices being heard.
Where do you go from here as the Cameroonian Bar Association? Where do you go from here after your strike? What happens next?
I think we'll have to continue to work. But we have to draw a line as far as the civil and the common law bar is concerned. I think our colleagues from the civil law jurisdictions have finally understood that we are running two systems. In their system, magistrates can do what they think they can do to lawyers. But under the common law system, judges cannot lord on lawyers because they are trained from the same school and they have to interact the same, they have to reason the same, I mean, they have to argue the same. It is just matter of players and a referee, and the referee is a judge.
Barrister Amungwa Tanyi is a Cameroonian lawyer. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Driving While Black, Race, Space, and Mobility in America, a documentary by filmmaker Rick Burns and historian Gretchen Soren, traces the racial profiling African Americans have encountered on the road since slavery. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the film's creators.
Driving While Black, a documentary by Rick Burns, chronicles the discrimination and violence African Americans have often encountered while driving.
In order to understand what's happening today, we felt strongly that you had to go all the way back to slavery, because that's the point where freedom is denied and mobility is denied.
The film documents how during the U.S. antebellum era, plantation owners employed slave patrols to monitor and punish slaves who tried to escape. It portrays the slave catchers as a precursor to white supremacists and some local sheriffs of the post-slavery Jim Crow era who targeted African-American motorists from the 1920s to the 1960s.
Liberty is locomotion. It was a form of self-empowerment. You drive, automobile. You get to go where you want, when you want, not sit in the back of the bus, but also an opening to a whole world of challenge as you now must navigate this spaces where African mobility is seen as worrisome and unpleasant and to be stopped by a large cohort of white Americans.
Perils grew for black motorists at night.
So one of the hazards of driving was encountering people who were less interested and you being in that particular neck of the woods. And I say neck of the woods, a neck in the woods, you know, watch out for, you know, being lynched or being harassed or terrified.
How do you navigate the segregated highways of America if you're an African American, where if your daughter needs to go to the bathroom, if you need to put gasoline in your automobile, if, God forbid, you have a medical emergency, where are you going to sleep? Where are you going to eat? Where are you going to get your hair done?
The Negro Motorist Green Book listed such places. It was published in 1936 by New York postal carrier Victor Hugo Green and put small African-American businesses across the country on the map. Eventually, says Rick Burns, the expansion of America's highways offered a level of protection to African-American drivers, giving them alternatives to state and local roads. However, the film shows African-American drivers continue to be racially profiled and disproportionately likely to be stopped by the police.
And so if people want to say, what is this thing, structural racism, systemic racism, which has this kind of like abstract quality at first glance? It's not abstract. It's profoundly concrete.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, is calling on the Sudanese transitional government to allow her office to visit Darfur and gather evidence against militia leader Ali Kushaib, who is now on trial for war crimes committed in Darfur. Ms. Bensouda says her office also wants to pursue former Sudanese officials wanted by the court, including former President Omar al-Bashir. For viewing, Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
In a meeting yesterday, members of the UN Security Council praised the transitional government's progress so far, but called for more steps to achieve justice in Darfur and throughout Sudan. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda presented a report on Darfur to members of the Security Council via remote. The prosecutor's latest report on Darfur focused on the ongoing trial of Sudanese militia leader Ali Muhammad Ali Abdurrahman, also known as Ali Kushaib, the first trial to address mass killings of civilians by Sudanese armed forces, along with other cases in Sudan. Bensouda noted positive development in the Juba peace agreement signed between transitional authorities and a coalition of armed rebel groups in October. The parties committed to justice for Darfur victims by creating a special court for crimes committed in Darfur, the establishment of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and their full cooperation with the ICC regarding five officials and military leaders charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur.
Indeed, the parties committed to facilitating the appearance of those wanted before the ICC, providing ICC prosecutors and investigators with access to victims, witnesses, and investigation sites, and allowing ICC personnel to freely travel throughout Sudan. The Juba Peace Agreement also states that the parties shall not interfere with ICC investigations and shall ensure the safety of victims and witnesses.
Sudan's transitional government has struck down provisions in its criminal code that previously prevented cooperation with the ICC that would pave the way for the possibility of handing over individuals accused of war crimes in Darfur to the ICC, including former President Omar al-Bashir. Despite repeated commitments to justice and the protection of civilians in Darfur and throughout Sudan, serious abuses against civilians in Darfur have continued, according to Bensouda.
There are repeated allegations of attacks on civilians in Darfur occurring mainly in June and July. These attacks reportedly resulted in significant casualties. Alarmingly, there are continuing reports of sexual and gender-based violence and crimes against children. Attacks such as these must stop, and the protection of civilians must remain a priority.
In 2009 and 2010, the ICC issued two arrest warrants for then-President Bashir for multiple counts of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur between 2003 and 2008. Other arrest warrants were issued for three top political and military officials in Bashir's administration, along with one rebel commander from Darfur. After evading justice for 13 years, Kushaib surrendered himself in June to authorities in the neighboring Central African Republic. He was transferred to The Hague to stand trial for 50 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur between 2003 and 2004. Bashir and two top former officials, Abdurrahman Hussein and Ahmed Haroun, are being held in prison in Khartoum on lesser charges related to corruption and staging a 1998 military coup in Sudan. One rebel leader from Darfur, Abdullah Banda, who has also been indicted by the court, remains at large. In October, Bensouda traveled to Khartoum, where she met with top government officials and civil society to seek cooperation with prosecuting Kushayb and four other suspects. Bensouda says, while in the Sudanese capital, she stressed what she calls the urgent need for her investigators to be granted access to the entire country of Sudan.
I emphasize that time is of the essence, as my team strives to meet the various deadlines set by the court's judges in Mr. Abdulrahman's case. I reiterate this call and urge this council to impress upon Sudan the urgent need for my investigators to access its territory and in particular to conduct investigative missions in Darfur without further delay.
The ICC chief says her office submitted a draft memorandum of understanding on modalities of cooperation on Darfur cases to Sudanese authorities shortly after her visit in October and is still waiting for a response from the government.
I take this opportunity to appeal to this council and through you to the authorities of the government of the Sudan to intensify the dialogue with my office in relation to these outstanding warrants. We must ensure, with full respect for the principle of complementarity, that all the ICC suspects are brought to justice through fair, objective, and independent proceedings, either before the court or in the Sudanese court, guided by the requirements of the Rome Statute.
Bensouda says the council can play a decisive role in expediting the process and ensuring Sudan's full and prompt cooperation with the ICC, adding that victims of atrocities in Darfur want to see real progress in the pursuit of justice. Julian Simcock is deputy legal advisor at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Simcock agrees that Bashir and other individuals accused of crimes should be brought to justice.
There are few in Sudan who deserve to face justice more than Omar al-Bashir. Although we are encouraged by his recent conviction for financial corruption, we believe more needs to be done to pursue justice and accountability, specifically with regard to his alleged responsibility for acts of genocide committed in Darfur and other atrocities committed throughout the country.
Simcock says the United States supports Sudan's efforts to uphold democratic values, strengthen an independent justice system, and pursue legal reform to ensure equality for all, regardless of gender, religion, or ethnicity. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Social media on the internet generates billions of users' access to quantities of news and information they would not have had 20 years ago, when newspapers, magazines, and network television still reigned supreme. That is according to a report published last week in Online Information Review. The study issued recommendations to counter misinformation and its effect. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the study co-author Yang Cheng, an assistant professor of communications at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. She began by defining misinformation itself.
Misinformation is not accurate information, right? And the person may not know that it's false news, but it's just get transmitted online so rapidly and widely.
What are some examples of misinformation about COVID that you discovered?
For example, COVID-19 is just a big flu, and we don't need to wear the mask, or wearing the mask is a political issue. And one of them is that eating ice cream can treat the COVID-19 disease. But actually, it's not true, right? All of those kind of inaccurate information, which is very, very significant for the current U.S. context.
In simple terms, how did the test work?
So we did a very formal academic study with 1,793 U.S. adults, and we did a panel study, which means that based on the U.S. census data, we randomly send those surveys to participants, and then we got around 2,000 people who sent their answers to the study. At the beginning of the survey, we give them the definition of misinformation. And then we ask them, during the pandemic, have you ever encountered a specific misinformation in your daily life? And we ask them, what may be your emotion triggered by those misinformation? And what may be your impact on yourself and on others in society?
And your studies show that people often have a false sense of their own sophistication when it comes to evaluating information.
In this study, overwhelmingly, we find that people always think like others are vulnerable toward misinformation. But me, right? I'm smart. I'm better. I'm good at identifying misinformation by myself. We find that this phenomenon is prominent in the U.S. context during the pandemic.
Many of your respondents were in favor of government checks on misinformation. What did you and your fellow researchers conclude might help?
From this study, we advise that scientific educators should notify teachers from misinformation and realize its harmful impact. And engaging people's attention about misinformation can help them to identify, evaluate false information. And then prioritizing scientific information to bring people more attention toward the facts. And then in quite a few journalism program and communication departments, they already start a course about media ethics and media literacy. And some media institutions now in the U.S., they are also doing a better job. When, for example, the president continued posting that he won the election, Twitter marked that it may not be true or different from what the other media posted. So this is another way to help people to identify the misinformation.
What advice would you personally give to social media users?
I have several suggestions. First is that people should improve their own media literacy. You have to think for a second more. And then every time when you see the misinformation, you develop your ability to identify it, right? So that's how we as social media users, we can improve along the way.
That's Yang Cheng, an assistant professor of communications at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Moyo wangu umepoteza furaha, amani sina tena,
sina tena.
Masikini penzi langu, kazi manyota ya ja. Kani mwaga kani tema. Naishi kwa kutapatapa, anajifanya oni. Chanzo yeye, ananizingua, nakaribia kudata. Yamenifika shingoni, arudi japo, nipone ugua, au tatizo misina. Kachotaka ni nina, nimechacha nimechina. Kimuona mwambieni,
bado nampenda, bado nampenda, bado nampenda, bado nampenda.
Fanya maharufu, penzi sherehe kwa madufu. Ona kakivunja kibubu, ah, minateketea. Sauti yake ya kasuku, yanijia huku na huku. Nikizivuta kumbu kumbu, ah, zinanirudia. Nalikumbuka tujina,
ameumiza mutima akaling'oa na shina. Ho jamani, naishi kwa kutapatapa, anajifanya oni chanzo yeye ananizingua, na karibia kudata, yamenifika shingoni, arudi japo nipone ugua au tatizo misina, yani misina kachotaka ni mimina, nimechacha nimechina.
For a second, so I'm thinking tonight. Break the ice, and better still, we can set it aside. Temporarily, my temperature is telling me that you got me so hot. Stuck, girl, there is no remedy. But you don't know me well enough to reply. And I don't really know you that well. It's funny, you have something in your teeth, but would you try to stop me if I wanna take it out? Cause you don't know me properly. Girl, I think you're lovely, but you turn this bad boy into a busybody. I see you're too busy for me. Or maybe I'm just busy for me. Will you call me when you're ready for me? It's crazy, baby, how I don't care at all. Then I don't really know you that well.
I really wanna tell you
how my day went.
Really want to spend the weekend. I for sure you this thing I'm feeling.
Oh yeah, but I don't really know you that well. But me, I don't know why I think I love you when I don't really know you that well. We can go there if you want to. But me, I don't know why I think I love you when I don't really know you that well.
So you be my controller, see me, see this parola. I just wanna come home to you, spend every night telling bad jokes to you. Be my boyfriend, I'll be up in my boyfriend jeans. Have a baby with but I don't really know you that well. I wanna go with you, do this life with you, ride or die for you, but I don't really know you that well. I really wanna tell you
how my day went.
Really want to spend the weekend. I for sure you this thing I'm feeling.
Oh
want to fuck me, I don't know why I think I love you when I don't really know you that well. We can go there if you want to fuck me, I don't know why I think I love you when I don't really know you that well.
Zaga that. Team coming body ten ten. It's your boy.
It's P. Kelly.
My baby, they confuse me, yo, with that bum bum. But she got the guy where they send her money from London. Mm-hmm. She they see me like a Johnny just come. Yeah. My monkey, they walk it. Baboon, he just the chop. Me, I go chop all the washing. As long as you give me my passion. Baby, make you know they rush me. I beg you, make you treat me with caution. Leg over. My baby, give me leg over. Hangover. Baby, she did give me hangover. Hey, leg over. Oh, no, man, give me leg over. Hey, game over. She did come give me game over.
Hey, I just confuse you. I dey confused when you turn around, baby. You dey make her confuse. You do all I like it. A Cameroon, mess when rise the boy, and baby make her confuse. Commando, you be commando. You dey command the boy, you be overload. Yeah, yeah. I know fi stand alone. I must call my guy before rendezvous.
Yeah, I go chop all the washing. As long as you give me my passion, baby, make you know they rush me. I beg you, make you treat me with caution. Leg over, my baby give me leg over, hangover, baby she dey give me hangover, hey, leg over, oh no me give me leg over, hey, game over, she dey come give me game over, ah. Baby, they distract me, yo, with a bum bum. But she get the guy where they send her money from London. Mm-hmm. She they see me like a Johnny just come. My yeah. Monkey, they walk it. Baboon, he just the chop. Me, I go chop all the washing. As long as you give me my passion. Baby, make you know they rush me. I beg you, make you treat me with caution. Leg over, my baby give me leg over, hangover, baby she dey give me hangover, hey, leg over, oh no me give me leg over, hey, game over, she dey come give me game over, ah.
I know if you stand alone, I must call my guy before rendezvous.
Après c'est un bon voyage, ce qui n'est ligné au balété. Bye bye chérie, ne reviens plus jamais.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sale, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a lion cannot hear its own roar. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Africa.